Now, this whole empire becomes Christian in the 4th century A.D. with Theodosius. Theodosius the first and second. The dates are 378 to 395 for Theodosius the first. Christianity is declared to be the only permitted religion. Persecutions begin, as I've said time and time again. But for us, the important thing is the missionization in that early period of the British Isles. The British Isles become Christian. And with the story of Patrick, Ireland becomes Christian in the 5th century. Now, one of the paradoxical calamities of Christianity was that after Rome had been Christianized, it fell. Augustine, the whole point, really, of St. Augustine's city of God is, yes, the city of man has fallen, but the city of God has triumphed. Well, that was small comfort. The fact was that the place collapsed. The Christians were actually comparable, I would say, to communists in our part of the world today. They were eating it out from inside, what the Chinese call the maggots. And not only that, but the Germans were pressing down from the north. And this pressure became emphatic when Attila the Hun comes smashing in from the east, and one German tribe after another was pushed westward and just in terror, you might almost say, broke down through the Roman Empire. With that, in the 5th century, the Romans have to shorten their lines. And the whole Roman defense line up the Danube to Britain is pulled back. They pull their troops out of England. That leaves England, after 500 years of Roman occupation, like an oyster with the shell taken off. And what begins to happen? The Celts from the Picts from the north, there were no Celts there at that time, the Picts from the north begin pushing down, the Celts from the west begin pushing in, and the Germans from Jutland come into England. There's a long story here of the collapse of British rule in what then became England. But it is that moment, the collapse of the Roman Empire, the invasions up and down the line by the Germanic tribes, the inadequate defenses of the Celtic people, particularly of Britain, that is the background of the Arthurian legend. Arthur is described in the old chronicles, the chronicles of Gildas and Nennius, of his time, shortly after, of the 6th and 8th centuries, as a dux bellorum, a leader in war. And what is now pictured by the scholars of this subject is a sort of Roman-trained military man who helped the kings of southern Britain in their battle against the invading Germans, that is to say, against the Anglo-Saxons and Jutes from what is now Denmark. The southern part of Britain was the field of the collisions. The chronicles tell of 12 great battles in which Arthur, Dux Bellorum, this Roman-trained military man, like, say, some Senegalese officer trained by the French, was assisting the kings of the south. And at the last of the battles, Arthur is killed, and the German triumph is confirmed. During the course of this invasion, there were, of course, refugees, particularly from southwest England, who went to what is now called Brittany in France. The whole Britain Peninsula is populated by people who were refugees from Britain. And there grew up in their world what is called the hope of the Bretons. The hope that Arthur would return and restore to them their homeland in the south of England. So, we have as the historical moment underlying the image of Arthur, this period in the late 5th and early 6th centuries, and say, let's say from about 450 to 650 or to 550 or something like that, of these invasions. Then we have a period of oral legendary reciting the deeds of this great deedsman and the building up of the hope of the Breton legend, namely of Arthur as one who will return to restore their world to them. It's out here in this country, it's a little bit like the hope that inspired the ghost dance religion at the end of the last century in America. That the ghost dancers would dance and dance and dance, and that another land would come over the land that the white people had taken, and only the Indians would be able to jump up onto that land, and the buffalo would be there, and the old world would be there again. This is the kind of thing that that is a common motif in the traditions of defeated peoples. Now, where is Arthur meanwhile? There are three principal interpretations of where Arthur is residing. One is that he is under a burial mound, sleeping in the hill, you might say. This is a motif that we get throughout the world too. The sleeping giant, the sleeping savior in the tomb, in the great burial mound. Another view is that he's residing in the lower half of the world, in the Antipodes, among the pygmies and dwarfs of those of the South Pole or something like that. But the most charming and the most popular was the story of him sleeping in the island of the West, Avalon. Now, Avalon is a Celtic formation of the word apple. Apple and apple, the P goes back, becomes a V, apple. Avalon is the land of the golden apples, the counterpart of the classical Greek Hesperides. An eternal land, a timeless land, like the timeless world of the sleeping giant in the hill. It really is the world of the unconscious. It's the world beyond time and space. The world of the Sambhogakaya, of the mythological forms that endure beyond time and yet are not the void. It's between the realm of the void and the realm of phenomenality, the realm really of dream and vision. That's where he sleeps. And that realm was in the past and is in the present and is to come. It's all around us, like the silence around Om.